Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On Podcast, where we talk about issues affecting veterans after they get out of the military. Before we get started, I'd like to ask a favor. If you haven't done so already, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. If you've already done that, thank you. These ratings help the show get discovered so it can reach a wider audience. And while you're there, click the subscribe button so that you get notified of new episodes as soon as they come out. If you don't use Apple Podcasts, you can visit driveonpodcast.com/subscribe to find other ways of subscribing, including our email list. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and now let's get on with the show. Over the weekend, on August 22nd, our family observed the 10th anniversary of my brother Steven's passing. For those listeners who might not be familiar with his story and how he passed away, my brother and I were both deployed to Afghanistan in 2010. On August 22nd, 2010, his unit was out on a patrol and they began receiving enemy fire. And Steve was killed pretty much as soon as the fighting had started. There is obviously a lot more to that story. And one of Steven's friends, Wes Black, talked more about that day back in episode 14. So if you're interested in hearing the story of the events that went on that day, please go back and give it a listen. That was a really good episode. Anyway, I thought I would do something different to honor my brother in this episode. I'm a firm believer that a person will continue to live on in our memories so long as their story is told by the people who knew them best. So I asked some of Steve's friends and family to record a few short stories about him. Now, if you're wondering why you might want to hear these stories, the stories serve two purposes. First and foremost, I wanted to share these stories for Steve's friends and family. It offers them an opportunity to hear some of the stories that they may not have heard before, or to reminisce on some familiar stories that will bring a smile to their face. And second, for any listeners who didn't know my brother or our family, it gives you an insight into a soldier's life. It makes at least one soldier's death just a little bit personal to you. That way, when you hear about a service member who is killed in the line of duty, you don't dismiss it as just another news story. You take a moment to listen to the story and think about the soldier, the Marine, the airman, the sailor, the Coast Guardsman, who was killed, and think about them as a real person. Think about them as someone's child or sibling or spouse, aunt or uncle, even just as someone's friend. Those service members all have stories of their own to share, and these are just a few of my brother's stories, and I hope you enjoy. First up, we have Steve's XO from the 2010 deployment, Micah Kidney.
Hello, my name is Micah Kidney, and I served as a first lieutenant and the company executive officer for Alpha Company during our deployment in 2010 to Afghanistan. Now I'm the battalion executive officer with 3rd of the 172nd, the battalion that Alpha Company fell in under during the deployment. And at this point, I'm a major. During our deployment in 2010, 3rd Battalion was attached to the 187th Airborne Task Force Rakasans. They were located at FOB Salerno, which was about 60 or 80 miles to our cell. 187 Airborne, they fell in under the 101st Airborne. At the time, 187th was commanded by then Colonel Viet Luong. He himself was a guy who emigrated to the United States as a child from Vietnam. Pretty cool story. He was an incredible leader who came in after August 22nd. After August 22nd, spent time with 3rd Platoon. I'll definitely never forget sitting out on the LZ at Combat Outpost Herrera. When he flew in on his Black Hawk, his command Black Hawk, and looked into our eyes. He had tears in his eyes, and he just wanted to share the fact that the loss that we felt didn't stop on a company level. He felt it up to his level, and it meant a lot to us, and we really appreciate it. Appreciated it at the time, and I still do. Anyway, Steve's job in 2010, he was a team leader with Alpha Company 3rd Platoon at Combat Outpost Herrera, which was in Jaji Province in eastern Afghanistan along the Pakistan border. His platoon was fantastic. They had a great young platoon leader and Charlie Flood and a fire-breathing platoon sergeant and Smitty and a couple of incredible squad leaders and team leaders, Chuck Ames, Isaiah Gomez, Steve DeLuzio, was one of those guys, and Rob Kucher. So their leadership in that platoon was top shelf. Combat Outpost Herrera was at the apex of three legs of what would look like a tripod, each consisting of a MSR, like a supply route in the low ground with mountains on both sides. First platoon on to the northwest up towards Barra, Shega, and Rokian. Second platoon owned the leg of the tripod to the south towards Sikandar Kel, Tarkanai, ANA. There was an ANA outpost down there and the Ahmad Kel DC, the district center. Third platoon, Steve's platoon, owned to the northeast up through Ali Kel, right to the east of our outpost, through Bedala, up about 10 to 12 clicks up to BCP 12, 13, and 14. Along the PAC border, looking down into the Pakistan city of Parashinar. So they had each platoon had a tough AO, but third platoon's AO was pretty big, and it was just a massive area of operations to own. Our company AO for the Taliban was like a web of like mountain trails and goat paths. For the most part, is a highway for Taliban fighters to enter Afghanistan from Pakistan during the fighting season, headed west towards Ghazni, north towards Jalalabad, but mostly towards the capital in Kabul to the northwest. And it was our company mission and each of the platoons' mission to disrupt and interdict that Taliban infiltration into the heart of Afghanistan. We also had a secondary mission to train the ANA, the Afghan National Army, the ABP, the Border Police, and the ANP, the Afghan National Police in Jaji, where we were located. I didn't know Steve before the deployment, but I was lucky enough to be out with platoons almost every day, and I got to know Steve pretty well. We came to know each other as lifelong hockey players who lived and breathed the sport, and we both loved the Bruins. We had quite a few like late night opportunities to watch the Bruins in the playoffs. As they coughed up that year a 3-0 series lead to the, I think it was the Flyers, but it was a tough season for the Bees, but that's kind of how we came to know each other. We'd play hoops almost every night. We had a little tiny basketball court, and Steve was a pretty horrible basketball player. It was definitely not his winter sport. Hockey was that, obviously, and many of those games ended with like one of us, and I remember Steve doing it, like punting the basketball outside out of the outpost into the local town after he or one of us lost. We also worked out a ton in the gym, but the story I'd like to share involved our nightly poker game. So there's about 10 or 12 of us who would play in my office. We had a good poker table set up, and it was just a bunch of the leaders in the company just kind of blowing off steam, having some fun at night. And Steve was a fairly, I would say, pitiful poker player, but we were all just in there for fun, and we were frequent opponents, like heads up on a table. And Steve had a curious habit of playing pretty poor hands and winning a lot, which was interesting. But also funny was when his 2-7 off suit or whatever it was didn't pan out and he lost, he'd become pretty furious. But this is kind of the setting of the story I'd like to tell. But Steve talked a lot of junk when we were playing. Obviously that was part of who he was, and we loved it. One night we were playing and he was so sure that he was going to win that he was willing to make a bet with a few of us that if he lost, we could choose any outfit of our liking for him to work out in the next day. And of course he lost. So the outfit that we put together was like a Hawaiian hula outfit, full to the nines, like grass skirt, actual coconut bikini top for him. So he had the bikini coconut top on, and he was working out, and I knew he was working out. So of course I was going to document the moment with a couple of pictures. So he was on the Stairmaster, one of the machines that we had in our little gym, and tooling away, and I busted through the door so he couldn't like hop off and try to look cool or, and like, I just remember him as I snapped the pictures away, like staring down at me, just laughing so hard, embarrassed, but, he was cool with it. I decided to take it a step further, and the next day I made up like 30 little posters with the picture of him in the outfit, put them all around the outpost, and I turned it into like a fake call to action for all the burqa-wearing Afghan females to shed their Pashtun ways and full body coverings and start wearing this hula, this Hawaiian hula outfit. And, you know, so it was pretty funny. I put them all over the outpost, and as we know, Steve like's not going to lose a prank battle. So he took it to the next level. And, the next day, someone told me to go over to my bee hut, and I went over to my bee hut, my little 5x8 little room inside of this plywood shack. And, there was like 30 people standing around waiting for me to go in. And I went in, and Steve and Chuck Ames had like shredded my bee hut room. And it was hilarious. Like all the games from the MWR, the checkers and the Connect Four, all that stuff was spread out through my room, about knee deep. He had taken multiple fire extinguishers and released their contents into my sleeping bag, which, by the way, if you didn't know, was purple, the stuff that comes out of there. So they shredded my room pretty good, and deservedly so, I guess. And I remember, I'll never forget, I came out of my bee hut incredulous, and Steve was right there in the front and arms crossed, and he I will never forget it. He goes, LT, when you mess with a big dog, you get the tea. And never forget it. It was a couple weeks later that we lost Steve in Rokan. Steve was the glue that kept the company together, and especially the leaders like E5s, E6s. He was just the best. I still can't believe he's not here. I'll never forget him. And my children know his name, as do my family, and my grandchildren will. Steve, I miss you, brother. We'll catch you on the flip side.
Next, we have a story from one of Steve's longtime friends, Zach Tracy.
Hi, my name is Zach Tracy. As someone who was friends with Steve for 20 years, there are countless stories about the times we spent together that I could share. Some are appropriate, some perhaps not. But the one story about Steve that most frequently comes to mind is one I wasn't involved with at all. Instead, I heard it secondhand from Steve with the help of Italian hand gestures and a level of embellishment he could have only learned from his father. Like all good stories, this one begins in the worst of weathers with sleet and snow falling on an almost barren I-91 in Vermont, as Steve drove up to Norwich Academy after a short visit home. For anyone who traveled with Steve in his blue Nissan Xterra, I'm sure you can envision him driving down the highway, blasting some loud and angry music, and happily drumming along on the steering wheel. As he drove on, the weather and roads got worse. A car in front of Steve started to lose control, slipping and sliding on the ice. In an effort to avoid the sliding vehicle, Steve hit the brakes and immediately found himself sliding around the frozen highway. Though he eventually managed to avoid the car in front of him, the car behind him wasn't so lucky. Once all the cars came to a stop, Steve stepped out into the sleeting weather and approached the rear vehicle to make sure everyone was safe. As he got closer to the vehicle, he noticed the color red splattered all throughout the car. Fearing the worst, he quickened his pace. When he finally got there, he hastily asked if everyone was okay. Confused by the rushed tone in Steve's voice, the driver looked around the car and then finally understood. "Oh, we're fine," the driver said with a chuckle. "My wife was just holding a pot of pasta sauce." Never forget Steve bursting into laughter immediately after telling me it was just pasta sauce. I'm always reminded of that story as I'm driving in bad weather. It speaks to who Steve was. He was always quick to help others in their time of need, but just as quick to find humor in any situation.
All right, next we have a couple stories from another soldier, Wes Black, who I mentioned earlier, deployed to Afghanistan with Stephen. These stories actually come from episode 14, the episode that I mentioned earlier. So if you want to hear more stories like the ones that you're about to hear from Wes, go give that episode a listen after you hear this.
The first time I met Steve was actually at a drill weekend, and it was Halloween weekend. And it was like a muta four, so it was a Saturday, Sunday, non-remain overnight. And so Saturday night, we got cut loose. And so, you know, all the guys had, because I had been in the unit for a little over a year, like I knew to bring civilian clothes to the drill, because if we got released, like we could go out into Burlington and raise hell. And so it's Halloween night, right? And so Steve kind of looks at me and he's like, bro, I don't have any clothes. Like, I don't have any civilian clothes. Because at the time, he was a freshman at Norwich. So freshmen aren't allowed, according to the Rook policy, you're not allowed to have civilian clothes. You could if you were in the guard, but Steve had only recently just come to drill and didn't know the rules. And so I was like, fuck it, man. It's Halloween. Like, just tell everybody you're a soldier. At the time, it was 2004. And I was like, just tell everybody you're a fucking soldier. Everybody loves fucking soldiers. I mean, we're fucking heroes, man. Just fucking go as a soldier. So he kind of, so he's like, all right. So we go downtown, right? And I'm in like civilian clothes. I think I had stopped and grabbed like a stupid mask or something at like one of the Halloween party stores. And so we're downtown in Burlington. Eating pizza and drinking beer at what was it, Manhattan Pizza or Mr. Mike's or something, like one of the pizza shops. And I had actually scratched my ID, the back of my military ID, because I was born in 1985. I had scratched it so where the 5 connects down to the bottom, I scratched away that side, and then on the other side I scratched it so it looked like a 3, and then used the Sharpie to color it in, like a fine point Sharpie. So I actually had an ID that said I was like 2 or 3 years older than I really was, and I was 19, so it said I was 21. So I would be able to get into all these clubs and drink, and I could go up to the bar and get drinks. In case the police were listening, I only did it once. Anyway, we're out, we're drinking, and I had set Steve up in the corner, and I was like, hey, listen, I'm going to go out to the bar. I'm going to get us a couple of drinks. I'm going to get us some food. And so at the time, I think he was with Lisa. And so I come back, and Steve was always a charmer. Like, he could strike up a conversation with the fucking wall. And yeah, I mean, he really could. So I come back, and there's these 3 women standing around the table that Steve is at. And I'm like, motherfucker. I was like, yeah, this is going to be a good night. So I sit down, and I was like, hey, what's going on? So we're sitting there chatting and chatting and chatting. And I look at Steve, and I'm like, yo, man, you going to bring these girls home? And he looks at me, and he's like, nope, I got a girlfriend. And I'm like, what? So sure enough, man, we went back to the fucking hotel room, and I'm sitting there going, are you fucking kidding me? And sure enough, he called Lisa. Hey, how's it going, honey? I was like, oh my God. So I rode his ass a little bit about that. And so the other side of Steve is after we had come back from Iraq. And so I came back from Iraq. I tried to go back to Norwich, and I just couldn't do it. So, I bummed around the Vermont Guard for a long time. And so when we were getting ready to train up to go to Afghanistan, Steve and I were in the same platoon. We were both team leaders, so we were both sergeants. I think he was assigned to 1st Squad or maybe 2nd Squad, and I was 3rd Squad. So I was the 3rd Squad Alpha Team Leader. I think he was like the 1st Squad Bravo Team Leader or 1st or 2nd Squad Bravo Team Leader. And so we were out one day at Fort Polk getting ready to train our guys. We'd set up a glass house, which is just tape on the dirt in the shape of a house. And we were going to do these close quarter battle drills and like train our guys on how to move through houses. And so we go walking out, and I don't know what it was. I turned to Steve, and I went to check him, right? Because Steve was a hockey player. He was a phenomenal hockey player. And he happened to get just low enough on me that when he and I went to check each other, he actually popped my right shoulder out, like dislocated it. And I was like, all of a sudden I'm like, oh fuck. And it, like my shoulder's killing me. And of course Steve feels bad instantly. He is like, oh my God, bro, like, I'm so sorry. And so he gets me over to the aid station, like, helps basically, like, carry my arm. And we get over to the aid station. The doc puts it back in. The doc's like, all right, listen, like, you got to take it easy over the next day or two. Like, just ice it, relax it. I'm going to give you, like, some compression bandage to put over it. I really want you to take it easy. So I'm like, okay. So we go back out. We do the training. We go back inside to sit down. And we had these big open, basically, barracks with all these little cots, right? And so I'm sitting on my cot. Mm-hmm. And Eric Kilburn, who was one of the guys, he was in second platoon. Very funny guy. Loved to, you know, just joke around with anybody. And Steve was the kind of person where he would make fun of anyone mercilessly, right? If he knew how to, if he knew how to push your buttons, that's exactly what he would do. But
yeah, the slightest opening,
he would expose me. Oh yeah, and he would dig.
Yeah.
But I will tell you what. Only Steve was allowed to do it, because if somebody else started doing it, Steve was the first person to be like, yo, motherfucker, shut the fuck. Like, he was very adamant that, like, he was the only one that could fucking needle you. And so I'm sitting on my cot, minding my own business. I think I actually had my headphones on. I wasn't paying attention. I was watching a movie. Well, Killy comes up with his pillow, right? And he just whacks me across the back. Just, he's trying to be funny. Like, he's trying to start a pillow fight. Except it pops my shoulder back out, because I had literally had it just put back in. And so, of course, I instantly buckle. I start crying because of the pain. Like, it fucking hurt, man. And so Killy kind of looks at me. He's like, yo, you all right, bro? And, like, I pull my headphones on. I'm like, motherfucker. So Steve comes flying over, like, literally puts his hands on Kilburn. He's like, yo, motherfucker, what's your fucking problem? And so Killy's like, whoa, I'm sorry, I had no idea. And I'm like, it's okay, man, like, don't worry about it. So Steve actually helps me get my shoulder pop back into place, because he watched the doctor do it, so Steve knows how to do it. So Steve helps me pop back into place, right? It feels better. So he sits down next to me, and I have, like, tears rolling down my face from the pain. It hurts so bad. And he looks at me, and he goes, you all right? And I was like, yeah, bro, it just fucking hurts, man. He goes, all right. And he kind of slaps me on the knee, and he goes, good. Get yourself fixed up, because you look like you just took second place in a drag race. And fucking stands up and walks away. I was like, you motherfucker. Like, but that was the kind of person that Steve was. Like, he would make sure you were okay, but he would make sure that he got one in as he was walking away.
Next up, my mom, and I guess, well, Steve's mom too, same person, has a couple of stories that she wants to share about him.
Hi, Scott. I just wanted to share a couple of stories that you may have heard, but many other people may not have heard about Stephen. One is an interesting story from when he was at his basic training in Fort Benning, Georgia. And when we all as a family went down to his graduation, the procession of soldiers were marching in front of us, and you guys were all saying, oh, there's Steve. And I couldn't see him. And the group was marching right in front of us. And I remember Lisa saying to me, he's right there. He's like the second one in the row. And I couldn't see him. And when they finally, you know, turned, they were facing us profile, and they finally turned and faced us straight on. It didn't look anything like Steve. As you know, he had a, you know, darker complexion, olive skin. But from the months of training in Georgia, his skin was very dark, and he had, I don't know how much weight he had lost, but he had lost quite a bit of weight that I totally did not recognize him. And I would say, I don't know, he was probably 30 feet in front of us or maybe a little more. But anyway, I didn't even recognize him. So I remember, you know, tears came to my eyes, because I was, you know, thinking as a mom, oh my gosh, he hasn't eaten in all this time that he's been here at basic training, and he's gotten so dark. But I guess the training did well for him, because when he got back to Norwich University, that first time they had like a some kind of competition in terms of agility and all that kind of stuff, and he came in first place. So I guess after the basic training regiment that he went through at Fort Benning, it definitely got him in really good physical shape. It's just his poor mom didn't recognize him. And the other story was, I think you probably heard this one too, but anyway, in all the years with Stephen, you know, there was always Stephen was always one to keep. You had to keep an eye on him because he was always, you know, doing crazy things that, you know, he had no fear. But anyway, as an adult, and he was now in the Vermont National Guard, he was there was a training coming up, a training weekend or whatever, and I know he had to have a weigh-in, and he had put on a few pounds, and so he was trying to, you know, exercise, and he went to the gym, and he was riding his bike, and he was doing all these things trying to drop the few pounds. I think he needed to lose another 5 pounds by the weekend or something, and so he was, you know, doing it through sweating and really working hard and not eating a lot anyway. So on this particular day, he had driven his bike, and as you might recall, those who knew, he had a mountain bike. It wasn't a, you know, typical bike that you would, you know, go riding down the streets or, you know, long distances on. But anyways, it was a mountain bike, and he had been gone for hours and hours, and it was a hot time of the year. I don't remember summertime. I don't remember the temperature exactly, but he had been gone for a long time, and I was actually beginning to worry that, you know, maybe something had happened. And so I, as a mom, maybe a helicopter mom, I don't know. But anyway, as a mom, I got in my car, and I knew the route that he was on because he was going to the gym, and then he was going to ride his bike back home. And so from where we lived, you know, I figured I knew which way he was going to go. So I went down this street, Hebron Avenue, for those who are from Glastonbury might know where the area is. I just started driving down the road, and there I see Steve, maybe halfway between the gym where he had been and home. He was riding his mountain bike up this pretty steep hill. And so, you know, he was going one direction, I was going the other direction. So the first street that I could, I turned around and I, you know, I kind of came up behind him, and he looked like he was really dogging it. I mean, he was going really slowly, and I wasn't sure he was going to make it up the hill. So I, you know, kind of rolled down my window and I shouted out the window, do you want a ride? Are you going to make it? Right. Well, he pulled over to the side of the road onto the sidewalk, and he was mad because he was kind of halfway up this hill. And because I had stopped, now he had to stop. He lost his momentum, and he's like, no, mom, you're gonna kill me, you're gonna kill everybody around here because you're, you know, stopping a bicycle on the road. And he was very upset that day, one of the few times that he actually did get angry. But he was, I think he was so exhausted, and he really did want to ride home, but he knew he couldn't, and so he was not happy with me that day. But anyway, I thought maybe I'd share those two stories, that of the many, many, many stories, happy and sad, that I have of Steve, but some people may not have ever heard those stories. So I just thought I would share. Thanks. Bye.
And finally, I have Steve's dad, my dad, again, same person. And I have to preface this next section with a little bit of background. So my kids call my dad Poppy. And one day, my wife and I were talking about the local PTA at the kids' school, the Parent Teacher Association. And my son looked at us as we're talking and asked, what's PTA stand for? Does that stand for Poppy Talks a Lot? And it's true, once when you get my dad on a roll, he doesn't seem to want to stop. So PTA became sort of an inside family joke. I figured I'd share that too, since we're having fun telling stories and everything. And true to his PTA form, here's my dad sharing some stories.
Geez, I don't know where to start. I've got so many crazy stories that we've been through in his short 25 years. But I think I'm going to go back quite a ways to talk about a little bit about what might kind of tell you about Steve's character. And, well, it might tell you more that he was a character and that he really was sort of fearless in a lot of regards. When he was 3 years old, his birthday is on February 25th, so when he was 3 years old, we bought him a two-wheeler bicycle with training wheels. And, of course, it was February in Connecticut, so he wasn't really able to, you know, use it all that much in the first month or two. But as it warmed up, it was Memorial Day weekend, and we lived in a cul-de-sac. And I'm out there playing with Scott and Steve and, you know, just messing around, and I see Steve ride his bike across the cul-de-sac. Now, remember, it had training wheels on it, but, you know, he's He rode it so hard that the training wheels over time bent up and they were off the ground. And as Steve went across the cul-de-sac, I noticed that the training wheels never hit the ground. I mean, the kid was riding a bicycle on two wheels. And so, you know, again, he was at that point in time, he was 3 years and 3 months old. Now, he still had diapers on, so I want to come back to that in a minute, just to let you know, okay? Because Steve had no time for that type of stuff. But anyway, I called Steve over, and sure enough, I said, hey, Steve, you know, I don't know if you know this or not, but you rode across the cul-de-sac with the training wheels never hit the ground. You can ride a bike. And he was a little bit afraid, and, you know, matter of fact, I took the training wheels off and got him back on the bike. Now, he was so small at that time, even that little bike, he had to get up on a curb to get on the bike. So I had to hold the bike for him. And sure enough, the kid took off. You know, he's driving a two-wheel bike with no training wheels at age 3 years, 3 months. And he was fearless, you know, and he was just kind of that way, you know. So now let's go back to the diaper. So he still had a diaper. Now, if you knew Steve at all, he couldn't shut up. You think I talk a lot? Oh, my God. Okay. And when he was at the dinner table, Diane would have to just continue to shovel food in his mouth. Otherwise, that kid would have died of starvation because he was talking away. He had no time to eat. He had no time for that kind of stuff. He had things to do. You know, he had to go play with his friends down the street. He had to go out and play baseball. He had to go do this. He had to do that. He had no time for basic human needs, like eating. Well, another thing he had no time for was learning how to go to the bathroom. So here the kid is riding a two-wheeler bike with no training wheels at age 3 years, 3 months, and he still has a diaper on, okay? Well, I don't know. It was maybe a month or two after that. We finally got him to, you know, not use the diaper, okay? And I won't go into any kind of gory details here on that one, but I think you can kind of imagine what that might look like. So here's Father's proud moment, my proud moment. I'm standing at the toilet with Steve, and it's the first time he goes standing up. And he's going, and it's coming out. And I'm standing there and I'm watching him and, you know, he turns to me and he says, hey, Dad, how do you shut this thing off? Right? I swear to God, he said that. And it's like, he had no time for that. I mean, he was too busy with life, you know, standing there and doing that type of bodily function was a big waste of time to him. You know, he was impatient and the whole event probably took a minute, but the minute was just too long for Steve. And that's where he turned to me and said, hey, Dad, how do you turn this thing off? In other words, I got things to do, man. I got friends to play with. I've got my bike to ride. I've got to go play baseball. I got to go do that. You know, so that just gives you a little insight as to Steve and how he looked at life, you know, and how he lived his life. He lived his life hard and fun. He got, you know, I would say he probably had more life packed into his 25 years than most adults at 90. So, you know, I think they always say it's not the quantity of years, it's the quality in those years. So anyway, a little bit of clip about Steve, and I thought I'd just kind of share that because that was kind of one of the many comical things that we've encountered with that guy. And, well, sure miss him. Now we're going to turn to Steve being 16 years old. And of course, every teenager who, you know, turns 16 wants to drive a car. Now, just to let you know, and Diane didn't know this, but both Scott and Steve and I took driving at 13. I let them drive at 13. But I did it as a matter of fact, it's kind of ironic, but I did it at the cemetery where Steve is buried right now. There's a road that goes around the cemetery, and I thought that was a pretty safe place. And I told both kids, I said, hey, look, if you crack up and kill yourself, you're in the right place. We're not to really move you, you know. Just kind of a joke. But anyway, so anyway, I would take them there, and my promise to them privately was that when they turn 13, I'm going to let them get in a car, and I'm going to take them to the cemetery and let them drive around a few times and get a feel for the car, right? Probably so irresponsible for me as a father to do that. But then again, Diane always said she had three boys, right? Three kids. So anyway, lo and behold, Steve turns, 16, and now it's time for him to take his driver's test just to get his permit. Now, the driver's test is only 10 questions, and you have to get 7 out of 10 right, 70%. So, I don't know, a couple of weeks before, I ordered the book, The Driver's Manual, and I brought it into Steve's room. Of course, Steve was in there playing video games or watching the Bruins or doing whatever Steve did in his room. And I said, hey, Steve, I threw the book at him. And I said, hey, Steve, take a look at this book. You got to study it because, you got a test coming up. And he looks at me and he says, I don't need this book. I go, what do you mean you don't need the book? He says, I know how to drive. Steve, I don't think you understand. Okay. I wouldn't pass the driving test today. There are screwy rules. How many feet do you park from a fire hydrant? And, there's all kinds of crazy rules that they're going to ding you on. And maybe the question might be, is it 25 feet? Is it 20 feet? Is it 15 feet? How do you got to study this stuff, Dad, I know how to drive. I know how to drive. All right, Steve. There's the book in case you want it. I'm telling you, you got to study it. You only get 10 questions. Ah, I got this, Dad. Don't worry. You know how Steve was, with that face. And the other thing, just like I said on the diaper story earlier, he had no time for that stuff. I mean, he had things to do, man, so that was a distraction. He was confident. He got this thing. And so anyway, I take him down to motor vehicles, right? And we apply for his permit. We fill out all the paperwork. Now, at the time, they had a manual test. All it was a one-page piece of paper with 10 multiple-choice questions on it. So Steve takes the test. He goes over and he sits down on the desk and he fills it out. He handles it. He hands it in and he looks at me and, yeah, I got this, he says, I go, okay, let's see, right? So anyway, we're literally standing over the guy who's correcting his test. Okay, he says, okay, let's see how you did, he says, right? And the guy has a red, I don't know, it was like a red pencil, And so question number one, wrong. Question number two, wrong. Question number three, wrong. I looked at Steve. And he looked at me, and he's shaken, okay? But he doesn't want to show it, okay? He's shaking in his pants, right? Matter of fact, if I had looked, there might have even been a puddle on the floor, speaking of diapers. And so now he's shaking. I'm looking at him, I said, told you, Steve, I'm like, told you, Steve, I didn't say that, of course. I'm just like, my look to him was like, I told you, you should have studied, you didn't listen. Next 7 questions, correct. He got them all 7 right, okay? So he passes the test, right? He looks at me and says, I told you I had this. I had this all along. I knew I had this, I go, you little shit. You cocky little, I said, you were crapping in your pants. Don't give me that stuff. I was not. I had this, man. I had this. I'm cool. I had this, That's Steve, okay? That's Steve living on the edge, okay? And that test was so representative, if you will, of Steve in general, right? So anyway, I thought that was a pretty cool story with Steve. Let's see. I'm coming back. This is back in the – well, Steve was 16 years old when this happened, so – okay, I'm coming back, I think, from Japan, and I connect over in, I don't forget where now, maybe Chicago or something, or wherever, and I'm flying back to Hartford. Again, that's where we used to live in Connecticut, and I'm sitting in first class, and of course, who comes sitting next to me but Rich Eisen? Now, Rich Eisen, at the time, was with ESPN, And he heads up the NFL Network now on TV, if you ever watch the NFL Network. So Rich Eisen happened to be Stephen's favorite announcer on ESPN. Now, first of all, Stephen knew more about sports, I think, than Rich Eisen did. I mean, Stephen knew so much about sports. I'll deviate for a minute here and tell you that during one of the Olympics, Stephen says, "That guy sucks. He's no good, but that guy right there," and he had all the names. He knew all the names of the players. He was talking about the curling team. The curling team. He knew which guy sucked. He knew which guy was good on a curling team, and he knew their names. You know, the kid was an unbelievable. I mean, I would argue with him about sports all the time. You know, Red Sox, Yankees. He was a big Yankee fan, and I'm being the big Red Sox fan, and I could never win a freaking argument with the guy. He knew so much about. You know, baseball is a world of statistics, and I think Stephen was a walking computer in that regard. He knew every freaking statistic that you can imagine. Anyway, I think he missed his calling. He could have been a great ESPN announcer or commentator. So anyway, Rich Eisen sits next down to me, and I looked at him, and I said, "Oh, you're Rich Eisen." Now, there are a couple other guys. I think Mike Tirico was with him, and somebody else, I forget. But anyway, he goes, "Yeah, I'm Rich Eisen." I go, "Well, you know," I said, "I gotta let you know." I said, "My son's 16 years old, and he's a big, big sports fan, and you are his favorite. I'm not telling you that. He really likes you," I said, because Rich Eisen had that sense of humor and all that stuff. So he really, you know, Steve really liked Rich Eisen. So anyway, we're talking, you know, all the way through. He's a really nice guy. We're talking about all kinds of stuff, you know, we talked about his career, how to get started, and we talked about some sports and all that stuff. So he says, so the flight's landing now in Hartford, and he says to me, "Hey, I have something. You're going to be checking you're going to go picking up your bags?" I said, "Yeah, I have a bag to pick up down in baggage claim." "Well, I'll tell you what, I have something for Steve," he says. "Once you know, listen." So so Richard Eisen and I walked down to baggage claim in the old Bradley Airport, he and I are talking, and we're waiting for our bags. He said, "Hey, I'll be right back." He says, "I have to hit the restroom." I said, "Okay." So while Rich Eisen's gone, I take out my cell phone, and I call Steve. And I said, "Hey, Steve." He goes, "Yeah." I said, "Hey, you're not going to believe who I just sat next to." And he didn't believe me because I kid around a lot, you know, as you might expect. I kid around a lot with the kids. And I, "No, Steve, I swear to God." He wouldn't believe me, right? I said, "No, I sat next to Rich Eisen from Chicago. We talked all the way through. I told him you were his favorite, or he was your favorite." And really, Steve, he didn't believe it. So Rich Eisen's coming back from the men's room. I said, "Well, you know what, Steve? Here he is. I'm going to put him on the phone." He goes, "No, you're full of, no, really." Okay. I said, "Hey, Rich, you want to talk to my son, Steve?" He goes, "Yeah, sure," right? He takes the cell phone. He goes into his announcer voice. He had a totally different voice when he got on the cell phone, like he would be on TV. He goes into his announcer voice, because normally he was just talking regular. Then he goes into his announcer voice, and he's talking to Steve, right? He's projecting, you know? So I'm just hearing one side of the conversation. All of a sudden, I hear Rich Eisen say, "Well, they have to win, man. I'm not going to put them on if they're not winning." I later found out Rich Eisen says, "Yeah, hey, you got quite the son there," he says. I go, "What do you mean?" He says, "He was giving me crap about not showing enough Boston Bruins coverage on ESPN. And I'm laughing my ass off. It's like, here's his idol, his announcer. And Steve's giving him crap about the fact that, and he's 16 years old, you know? He's giving him crap. Another insight to Steve and what he was all about. So not only was he an unbelievable sports fan and extremely knowledgeable about sports, but you can see his character. He didn't care if this was a big star or not. He was going to tell him what he thought, you know. And another story about Steve. Steve was 15 and Scott was 18. We were on a European cruise. Diane and I took the kids over to the Mediterranean. One of the stops that we had on the cruise was Naples, Italy. And I said to the kids, I said, "You know, this is where pizza was invented. Let's go into town for lunch and we'll have pizza." Now, Scott was 18 years old. Now, of course, here in the States, the drinking age was 21. I said to Scott, if the drinking age is 18, you could drink. If we go to a country that is 18, you can have a beer or, you know, wine, whatever. So Scott's, oh, okay, you know. So anyway, we're going to go, Diane and I, we're going to go into town and find one of those, you know, restaurants, sit on the roadside cafe type thing. So we're going in, and Steve says, hey, guys, I don't really feel like going in. I'm going to stay on the ship. Not really sure why, but anyway, we said, okay, well, you know, Steve stayed on the ship. And so it was Scott, Diane, and me. We all walked into town, found this nice little, you know, roadside restaurant. We ordered pizza. And of course, Scott had, I think he had wine. So I have no problem with that. That's fine. You know, I'm sure it wasn't his first drink. So anyway, we finished lunch and we walked back to the ship. And we go back to our room. And then all of a sudden, there's a knock on our door. And it's Scott and Steve. And Steve says, hey, Dad, Scott told me how good that pizza was down in town. And I want to go check it out. And I look at Steve. I said, Steve, does this say dumb shit up on my forehead here? You're not going in there for the pizza. No, Dad, really. I heard the pizza is like really good. And I don't want to miss the chance of having a pizza from Naples where it was, you know, invented. All right, Steve, have fun, you know. Okay, Scott, keep an eye on him. Have fun, Steve, right? So Scott and Steve go into town. You know darn well. I'm sure they ate pizza. Don't get me wrong, but I'm sure that really wasn't the objective of the trip. Anyway, again, that's Steve. You know, that's Steve kind of, you know, working the system and working all the angles. Another Steve DeLuzio story. Let's see. I'm trying to put him in an age bracket here. He was, he was a teenager. Well, let me give a little backdrop here first before I get into the actual story. So anybody who knows me knows that there's a couple of things I'm not very good at. One is being a handyman. I'm known for that. And my circular saw stories, that's a long one. Of course, my golf game. So anyway, I want to tell you that because I've never had an eagle in my life. I putted for eagle because I used to hit the ball really long. Once in a while, would end up on the green. And I putted for eagle many times, but never had one, right? So let me turn back to Steve. I've got a trip going to Ireland, and a week before the trip to Ireland, Steve and I are out in the driveway. We had a basketball hoop, right? And we're playing basketball, right? Well, anybody who knows Steve, first of all, Steve wasn't a particularly good basketball player, as was I. I was really good at baseball, but not basketball. I was a lousy basketball player. And as Sebastian Maniscalco might say, my favorite comedian, he says, Italians don't play basketball, okay? So Steve and I are playing basketball out in the driveway. And it's getting competitive, right? And we're talking, you know how Steve talks smack and, you know, and I think I do a little of that too. And we're just in our faces, right? So anyway, I'm going up for a layup. Steve comes and get, now Steve was a hockey player, right? He was a defenseman in his junior and senior years for the high school where they won the state championship in his senior year. And he was captain, one of the captains. Steve led the team in hits. Okay, he had more hits than anybody in both years. As a matter of fact, his senior year, he missed 5 games out of 20, and he still led the team in hits. Okay, because he had mono, he couldn't play for 5 games. Anyway, Steve was very competitive and very physical, okay? And you have to be a defenseman. So anyway, I'm going up for a layup. He gives me a check right in the ribs, okay? I mean, he checked me like you wouldn't believe. And I go down, okay? I'm on the ground, on my back, gasping for air, and I get up, and I have this pain in my side like you wouldn't believe, right? He broke my ribs. The kid broke my ribs playing stupid basketball in our driveway. So I'm in pain, right? So we go in, and, oh, Dad, I'm really sorry. Yeah, my ass, you're sorry. So anyway, I'm in pain, but you know, with a broken rib, you can't do anything about it. You have to just kind of let it heal, right? So, you know, go in and pop a couple Advils and, you know, and all that. So now I'm in pain all week, you know. Now I have to go to Ireland. So what do I do? Dummy me. I bring my golf clubs because we're going to be right by La Hinch. La Hinch is one of those famous courses that once in a while, I think they play the British Open on there, and it's a really cool, cool course, right? So here I am, dummy me, broken rib. I'm in pain, but I want to play this course really bad, right? So there's a par five, and I hit a really decent, I don't know, maybe 275, I hit a decent drive, right? But there's a big berm in front of me. We had a caddy. There's a big berm in front of me, and I couldn't see the hole, but he kind of pointed out where the hole would have been. I take out a four iron, and I just nailed this four iron. I knew I hit it well. I had no idea where it was going, right? Because I couldn't see the green. The ball lands on the green, and I get up to the green, and sure enough, I'm 10 feet from the hole, okay? And it's like, oh, my goodness, how the heck did this happen? You know, I checked the ball and make sure it was my ball. Yeah, it was mine. I sink the putt. It's a 10-footer, and I sink the putt. I get my first ever eagle in my life. And as a matter of fact, to date, that is the only eagle I've ever had. And I'm sitting there thinking about Steve. I'm saying, I don't think I would have done this if I didn't have a broken rib. Okay? I don't know. Maybe you got to play sick. I don't know. Maybe you have to play injured in order to get good. But I really thought, when I sunk that putt, the first thing I thought about was Steve in that basketball game. And I said, I just had an eagle with a broken rib. And I wonder if I didn't have this broken rib, whether or not I would have gotten the eagle. You know, so anyway, that's just how Steve kind of penetrates your life, and how Steve, was so darn competitive, unbelievably competitive. He did not want to lose. Another hopefully short story. This goes back to the late 2000s. So Diane and I took the kids to Scotland, and I wanted them to be able to experience playing some of the famous golf courses over there. So we played St. Andrews. We played Carnoustie. We played, you know, Kingsbarn, all the great courses over there. Anyway, so I remember driving from, I think, Glasgow into St. Andrews. And when Steve saw the clubhouse at St. Andrews, he was like floored. Remember, Steve was this big, you know, sports fan. So I'm taking him to the mecca of golf. I mean, this is where it started. They invented it here. Anyway, the day that we were supposed to play St. Andrews, old course, it rained like crazy. So it got postponed, and we're going to play, you know, a couple of days later. So we're in our rooms, you know, nothing to do. It's raining in Scotland, you know. And somehow Steve and Scott found their mini bar in their room. And they kind of cleaned up the inventory appropriately there. And soon thereafter, there was a knock on our door, and they come walking in, and they say, hey, are you using your mini bar? Are you using your mini bar? What kind of question is that? Am I using my mini bar? Yeah. You know, so what are you going to do? Unplug it and take it back to your room? No, I was wondering if you guys would do anything with it. All right. So they open up the mini bar, and they, you know, they clean it out. Okay. Now, anybody who knew Steve knew that if you had a chink in your armor, like we all do, he will point it out to you and he'll exploit it. Okay. Now, one of the chinks in my armor of many is that I'm fickle about making my bed in the morning. I can't stand to see a bed unmade. I don't know what it is. If my mother was here, right? You know, my mother's probably rolling over in her grave because I never made my bed growing up as a kid. When her attitude was, hey, it's your room. You want it dirty? My mother kept an immaculate house. You could eat off the floor. But in my room, she said, it's your room. You do what you want, right? I don't care. I just close the door so I don't have to see it. So I hardly ever made my bed. So now, you know, now I don't know how I got this bed fetish in terms of having to make my bed, but that's how I am. Steve knew that. So we're in our room. They come walking in, you know, and they're cleaning out our mini bar. And Steve sees our bed all nice and made. The housekeeper was in earlier and made the bed. He goes over to the bed, and he rips off all the covers, okay? Not only did he do that, he took the pillows and took the pillows out of the pillowcases, okay? He even took off the mat that's on the bed, on the mattress itself. He took that off, okay? He took everything off the bed. The bed had a bed skirt on it like they do over in Europe and, in the UK. And he took the bed skirt off. I mean, he totally stripped the thing, right? And I was rip shit, because he knew darn well that it would have gotten to me, right? And he was busting my chops. And that's how Steve was, right? So, dummy me, what do? I go back and I start making the bed while he's still in the room, okay? So, it takes me about 15 minutes to make the stupid bed because it was so, it was decimated. I mean, he took everything off. Matter of fact, he would have taken the mattress and thrown it out the window if he could have. I make the bed, get it back into condition. What does Steve do? He goes over again and does the same thing. I could have, if murder was legal, he would have bought the farm that day, okay? I was so ripped at him, right? And he's laughing, this doesn't face Steve. Like, he's just laughing his ass off, Scott's laughing. They're both laughing, And so anyway, I just thought I think I've heard so many different stories from Steve, from guys like Jesse Garcia and some others that's just how Steve operated over in Afghanistan too, which actually was a way of comic relief. And I think what I was told was it was his way to kind of check in on you to make sure you were okay. You always would look to see how you'd respond when he would come up and bust your chops, So, and I was a leader, right? That's what a leader does. So, everybody does it differently, but that's the way he operated. So, most of the stories I've told so far have been kind of humorous to give you a little glimpse of Steve's character and all that. Well, this one may be a little bit sadder. So Steve goes over to Afghanistan, as we all know, in 2010, along with Scott. They were both there at the same time. Not too far apart, I guess, 80 miles or so or 100, whatever it was. And although in Afghanistan, that's a very long way. Because of the mountains. But anyway, Steve and Scott were scheduled to come home, I think that November 2010, maybe December, I can't remember exactly which. But anyway, and we all know that Steve was killed in August of 2010, August 22nd of 2010, of which then, Scott was ordered home immediately out of battle to come home to be with his family. So anyway, Steve was scheduled to be married the following September in 2011 to his high school sweetheart, Lisa Goot, who, Lisa and Steve were going out for like 8 years, so we had a lot of the plans already made. We had the venue and all that stuff. And Diane was busy, with Cosby Goot trying to get everything kind of arranged and all that. Well, one of the things that I had done, and, I think I've told you earlier, Steve was a big sports fan and a big New York Yankees fan, unbelievably big. I think it was a Yankees fan because he knew I was a Red Sox fan. Anyway, but Steve always wanted to, go with the winners, and, you can't argue with their success, right? So anyway, I had arranged to have Bernie Williams, who used to play outfield for the Yankees, pretty popular guy. Bernie Williams is a classical guitarist, very good guitarist. And through a business connection, I know the guy who was president of Don Mattingly Baseball Bats. And I called him up and I said, hey, do you have any connections to Bernie Williams' organization? And because Bernie was retired now and he was just playing, he was on the circuit playing concerts with his group and classical guitar. So he says, yeah, well, I can put you in touch with Bernie's manager. Okay, so I called this guy. His name was Steve, too, and so I called him. Long story short, and matter of fact, Bernie Williams' manager was a veteran as well. I had arranged to have Bernie Williams play at Steven's wedding. Now, it was going to be a surprise. I was a little bit worried about this because I was afraid. We were afraid of taking the attention away from Lisa because that's really her day, But we thought, well, you know what? We think this is going to be okay. I think Lisa is one of those people who, is not self-absorbed, and she would not have had a problem with that. And so anyway, I had Bernie Williams arranged to play at Stephen's wedding. We weren't exactly sure, you know, how that was going to be done and, you know, when he would play and all that. All those details were going to be worked out later. But Bernie agreed to play, right? And so, of course, Stephen dies. And a couple weeks after that, I called Bernie Williams' manager and told him about what happened, right? And he was devastated. And so he went and told Bernie Williams what happened. And I never talked to Bernie directly. He left a message once, but Steve's, Bernie Williams' manager, Steve, called back and said, hey, Bernie stopped when I told him. He stopped his rehearsal and made the announcement to his band. And he said Bernie Williams had tears in his eyes, right? So we got a call, and Bernie Williams invited all of us to be his guest at his concert. He was playing down in Greenwich, Connecticut, and he invited us to come down to be his guests as to his concert. But we didn't go because it was only like, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks after Stephen died, and none of us were up for that. None of us were up for doing that, and we just declined and, you know, politely declined and thanked him very much and all that stuff. So anyway, I just thought I'd tell you that story about how, you know, one of the many things that we're going to miss would have been, you know, of many things, grandchildren and all that, is I still think what would have been the look on Steve's face when Bernie Williams shows up at his wedding, you know? And so anyway, that we'll always have to imagine. I can imagine what he would have said. But anyway, that's the story about Bernie Williams and Steve DeLuzio. So it was close, but no cigar. Another story. I don't know how many people out there believe in the afterlife or the spirit world or anything like that, but I could probably spend a couple hours telling you about the different things that have happened since Steve died. And I am sure that it is not the end. This life that we're in now is just a temporary stop. We've got work to do here. And then, I do happen to know that Steve and any of our, you know, past loved ones are with us today, and they're not gone. And, you know, as they taught us in school, energy cannot be created nor destroyed. It can only be transformed, and or matter, I should say, can never, you know. And so I truly believe that he's still with us. So I have a lot of stories, but I'm going to tell you one that was kind of mind-boggling to us. So as I've indicated on previous recordings, Steve would exploit the chink in your armor, okay? He would come up, and again, that was his kind of way of telling you he loved you, you know? But he would exploit the chink. So he would come up to me every once in a while and poke me in the stomach, and he'd call me Chunky Monkey. Hey, you got to lose 20 pounds, he says. What's going on? You know, hey, Chunky Monkey. He called me Chunks once in a while. Hey, Chunks, what's going on? You know? And he'd do that, you know, and that's just Steve. If you were bald, he's going to call you Baldy or something, you know? If you were, you know, whatever. That was just Steve. And of course, you got to give it back to him, right? So anyway, he'd call me Chunky Monkey, and you know that was kind of a joke between us. And so anyway, he goes off to Afghanistan, of course, and we all know he doesn't come back. And so about a month or two after he died that summer, there's a local farm in Glastonbury called Rob's. And Rob's farm, dairy farm, they make their own ice cream. It's really good if you ever get a chance to go there. It's on New London Turnpike. Anyway, we know the people that own it, the lady and the guy who, you know, own the whole farm and all that. So we heard that they had honored Stephen with the flavor of the month. So we go into the ice cream place and you know, the little shop that she has there, and we thank her. We said, hey, you know, we thank you very much for having this Sergeant Stephen DeLuzio flavor of the month. And she, no, the least we could do, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I said, hey, by the way, I said, what flavor did you pick for the ice cream of the month for Steven? She says, we picked the Chunky Monkey. Okay, I kid you not, of all the flavors in the world, and that's such a remote flavor. Like, you know, she said chocolate or vanilla, you know, but that's such a remote flavor. And she said, we picked Chunky Monkey. So she did not know anything about the story. She didn't know anything about the Chunky Monkey. I mean, I never told anybody except maybe, you know, maybe Diane or Scott or somebody like that. But nobody knew about this Chunky Monkey story at all. Okay. It wasn't on the internet. It wasn't in any of the press releases or anything else. And she picked Chunky Monkey. I looked up at the sky and I looked at, and I said, Steve, you son of a gun, you're still busting my chops from afar. Just another story. I think I've indicated in other recordings that Steve was an incredible sports fan. And in his early days, he started out liking the Dallas Cowboys, but I kind of convinced him otherwise, and he became a big Green Bay Packer fan, and he loved Brett Favre. So, you know, I've taken him to a lot of sports venues. One time we went to go see Green Bay play in Detroit at the old Silver Dome, and it's not there anymore. The Silver Dome at the time was the biggest stadium in the NFL, held like 80,000 people, and they were playing the Detroit Lions that day, and it was in 1997, and we got in the day before, flew into Detroit. Anyway, and the next day, I said, hey, Steve, we're just going to go to the stadium at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we're not going to bring anything. I don't have any kind of grill or any kind of tailgating equipment because we're traveling. I said, but I can guarantee you we're going to hook up with somebody, and we're going to, you know, experience what tailgating is all about. It was in the cooler part of the year, and I don't know if it was November or whatever. Steve had a Green Bay jacket on, a Green Bay Packers jacket and a Green Bay Packers hat. So we know at 9 o'clock in the morning, we get out of the car, and about a minute later, there's a group of guys. There's like 20 guys standing about, 100 feet away. And now they had this trailer. They had Christmas lights, music, food, all kinds of drinks. They had this whole thing going on, right? We're talking tailgating to the nth degree. So one of the guys spots Steven. Now, these guys had driven down from Green Bay. I think it's like a 7-hour drive to Detroit. Anyway, they've driven down and took this whole gear with them, this whole big trailer. And there's like 20 of them, right? And so from afar, one of the guys in the crowd says, hey, there's a Green Bay fan. Now, remember, we're in Detroit, okay? Hey, there's a Green Bay fan. So he yells over, hey, where are you from? Steve says, Connecticut. The guy looks at the other 19 guys and says, Green Bay fan from Connecticut. Let's go, guys. They run that whole distance. They all run, right? They pick Steven up. Now, I'm a New York Giants fan, okay? I want to get that on the record because it's going to be important in a minute. I'm a New York Giants fan. So they pick Steve up. They're throwing him in the air, okay? They're catching him. He's having a blast. They're just taking him and throwing him in the air and catching him, right? Are you his father? I go, yeah. Are you a Green Bay fan too? I go, yep. Come on over, right? We went over to there. We're eating. We're drinking. They're playing football with Steve. Music is playing. They had a generator running this whole contraption. And, you know, I said, hey, why does that generator have the tags on it still? The guy says, well, it's going back on Monday, you know. So we were the whole morning before the game for like 2 or 3 hours. We were with these guys just drinking and partying and eating. And they're having fun with Steve. It was a blast. Okay. So we finally, you know, have to leave and we have to go into the game. And it was a crazy game. Green Bay was killing them. There were more Green Bay fans in that stadium than there were Detroit fans. And you know the old na 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 song, goodbye? Green Bay fans were playing that to the Detroit fans as they were leaving the stadium, their own stadium. It was their own stadium. They were being kind of like not out of the stadium, okay? There were more Green Bay fans in that stadium, 80,000, and it was packed, it was 80,000 people, than there were Detroit fans, okay? Yeah, I would probably say 60% were Green Bay fans. And it was quite an experience. And again, that was the year that Brett Favre and, you know, Green Bay Packers won the Super Bowl. So that was another experience for Steve in terms of sports. He was like in seventh heaven about the whole thing. And we flew back that night, got back late, but he had a blast. And so that was just another day in the life for Steve DeLuzio.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to these stories. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen a bit to who my brother was from some of the people who knew him best. Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Drive On Podcast.